How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. Inspire change. Shape the future.
When we think of weather that can turn deadly, hurricanes, tornadoes, and flooding all come to mind. But it's actually heat that kills more Americans than any other type of extreme weather. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. This week, we're looking back at Chicago's devastating heat wave of July 1995. It led to 739 deaths, many of them elderly or low income. And it became one of the deadliest heat disasters in U.S. history. Here are some of your memories from that time.
I remember that my wife was 8 months pregnant with my daughter, and we lived on the third floor apartment. And it was really difficult because we didn't have any water because all of the fire hydrants were on in the neighborhood.
I came home. My mother was in a total panic. My grandmother, who was 94 years old, she had a heat stroke.
Back in 1995, I was working at City Hall hosting one of the mayor's annual senior citizens picnics. Those picnics were taking place in the days right before the heat wave reached its crescendo, and there were probably several hundred seniors who would come out to that picnic every year.
I also remember that the news media wasn't really telling us, giving us an accurate picture of how many people were dying because of the heat wave. It was the media overseas in Europe, in Spain, for example, that were reporting that there was 500 deaths in Chicago, where the Chicago media was downplaying it and giving numbers just in a couple hundreds.
Yeah, she did not make it. It was one of the most dreadful experiences of my life.
And I just remember looking at a lot of very, very warm, uncomfortable senior citizens, hoping that it didn't turn into a crisis. But in the days ahead, we certainly found out that it was a crisis.
Three Chicagoans joined us with their memories. Brandon Keller is a deputy commissioner for the Chicago Fire Department. In 1995, he was a firefighter in the Roseland neighborhood on the city's far south side. Maudlin Ihajerica is the director of journalism and storytelling for the Field Foundation. 30 years ago, she was a Chicago Sun-Times reporter who covered the heat wave. And Stephanie Bainey is a longtime Chicagoan and WBEZ listener who was living in Wrigleyville back in 1995. They all started with their biggest memories from the July 95 heat wave. Here's Maudlin.
Oh, my gosh. I remember I was an early career reporter, and I was assigned, I think I was covering urban affairs at the time and housing. And I was watching the heat and dealing with the heat myself and making sure that my family was fine. And then the numbers started to come in. The news started to come in. And I just remember everyone in that Sun-Times newsroom just sitting there with their mouths hanging open as the medical examiner began to release the reports of body after body after body after body being just funneled into his morgue. And that was our first indication that we were facing something serious.
Oh my goodness, I'm getting the chills just hearing you describe that. Stephanie, what did that bring about for you? Memories from 1995.
Well, what I remember the most is just the day-to-day, can this keep going? You know, I was a 20-something, a renter in Wrigleyville, living up on the third floor. And you know, one day it's a glitch. By the third or fourth day, it's like, what the heck is going on?
Yeah.
You know, Wrigley Field was ablaze with light, but the street that I lived on was dark. So every day it became going out into the neighborhood to find something to eat, to maybe get some ice for our cooler. It was like we were nomads trying to figure out how to live. And it was just what is going on? Mm-hmm. Just kind of a state of shock, I think.
Shock, and it sounds like a lot of confusion, too. Deputy Commissioner, how about for you? Biggest memory?
There's quite a few of them. What I can remember is the start of our shift, we were told that we would possibly be out on the street a lot because of the heat. And shortly after roll call, we were out on the street from roll call to probably 6 o'clock at night, mm-hmm. place after place. Most of the people we encountered were already either deceased or just about on their way there. We probably had an age range from 3 years old to probably 90, 92 mm-hmm. of the victims that we encountered.
What was that like?
It was rough. It was
to see from young children to our elderly just dead from the heat.
It was devastating. It kind of made you feel powerless because, you know, in our profession, we're put out there to help. And in this instance, you know, it was not a whole lot we could do. I mean, we could make recommendations about cooling centers and so on and so forth. But as a lot of us know, with the elderly, their protection and their stronghold is their house.
Yes.
So they'd rather do a box fan and take a shower and try to hold fast instead of, you know, risking going out in the street and risking not being able to get back home or
yeah.
Whatever.
So what you're describing then is, I mean, because I know that people were calling 911 and they were calling 311 and they were asking for well-being checks for their neighbor or their family member. And when you would show up, you were seeing sort of some different conditions that folks lived in, but people weren't always open to accepting your help.
Yes. It still happens, you know.
They wanted to stay there and tough it out.
Yeah, yeah. And there were some instances where we would go there in the morning, and one of the older people would already be deceased. Mm. And as we went throughout our day, we'd circle back later on that evening, and the other one would be gone.
Oh my goodness. Wow. And Maudlin.
Can I just say what that reminds me of is finding out that one of the issues was the elderly in the high crime neighborhoods, high crime, low poverty neighborhoods, were fearful of people coming in through their windows. So oftentimes the windows were nailed shut. They could not open their window and they were too fearful to go outside. So his story about not wanting to leave the house just, oh my God.
Heartbreaking.
Tell me more about it from your lens, Maudlin, as a reporter. As I mentioned, you're covering public housing at the time, also social justice for the Sun-Times. The two beats intersected, I'm sure. How did that coincide with the heat wave?
Yeah, you know, the thing about the heat wave is that while it was happening, we knew was that this was one of the most devastating things that ever happened in Chicago. And the politics of it, the blame game, Mayor Daley, you know, did he alert the constituency early enough? Did the weather service alert the constituency early enough? Who was to blame? And that's all that it was at the time. Later on, months later, we began to realize someone like me and other journalists who cover race and social justice mm-hmm. began to realize the statistics behind the numbers and how it had played out as a racial and poverty impact.
Tell me more about the stories that you then ended up writing during that time.
Yeah, and so, you know, those stories, it was about really making sure that I, as a journalist, hammered that home. You know, when you care about that stuff and when you cover that beat, you've got to make sure that is uplifted, that people understand, and that you drive some sort of action. And so the stories that I did were some of the kind of stories that he just realized, that he just brought up. There were stories where I would go out into Inglewood, what is now Bronzeville, but was not gentrified back then, near West Side, North Lawndale, into those communities. And I would talk to people, and those are the stories where people would say, my grandmother could not wait. By the time she realized she had to get out, she had no energy and she couldn't even open the window because we had taped it shut. I found stories like, you know, my grandparents had the fan going from the in the window.
Yeah.
What they didn't realize, it was only blowing in the heat. And mm-hmm. so they burned up from the inside
out. Of course. Yeah. And what's happening on the outside, too, is a lot of people in denial about just how serious this heat emergency was. Sadly, that included then Mayor Richard M. Daley. Let's listen.
You cannot claim everyone that has died in the last 8 or 9 days or continually die of heat.
How does it feel to hear that 3 decades later, Stephanie? You shook your head a moment ago.
I'm taken aback. I'm taken aback that he can, you know, say that so quickly without knowing the facts, it appears. And, you know, that's my first reaction is like, this is what people hear. You know, is this, I don't know. It just, it makes him look bad and it glosses over really the dangerousness and the seriousness of the situation.
Mm-hmm. Tell us more about how that week went for you. As you mentioned, you were living in Wrigleyville and you talked about that power outage that lasted days, yet games were continuing at Wrigley Field.
Yeah, that might be my strongest memory of all. My neighbors and I, a lot of 20-somethings, sitting out in their yard, you know, because it's too hot in the third floor, even at night, and just seeing that bright, bright light as if, you know, we want to take our apartment and plug it into the ballpark somehow just to have some basic, you know, utilities. You know, obviously that's not possible, but as the days went on, it just seemed, you know, it seemed so unfair. You know, they're able to conduct business there, and here we sit, day three, day four, and just in disbelief that it's still going on.
Yeah, and Wrigleyville, of course, did not see as many deaths as some other neighborhoods here in Chicago. But again, you must have seen at some point that the death toll was rising. Then it climbed over 700 to 739. So your reaction then?
Not until after. You know, we weren't monitoring social media in those days. We weren't plugging in our phones at night. So, you know, if we wandered somewhere to get something to eat, it was to talk to the neighbors. It was to see what, you know, what the immediate experience was. There weren't a lot of families that I knew living in our neighborhood. It was other people like me. And so, you know, have you heard anything? You know, what did you hear? More so than monitoring the news at the time until it ended, really.
And I mean, there was no social media. You said exactly. We weren't monitoring social media. I literally was trying to do the math. I was like, 1995, was there social media?
I almost said that, and I'm like, I don't want to get it wrong.
There wasn't, yeah. So, Deputy Commissioner, you're hearing all of this. I mean, even hearing the then mayor, tell me what that does for you.
it really agitates me because the extreme heat was the only catalyst there. I mean, the only oddball in the room was the extreme heat. You know, all the other circumstances by which people died or, you know, met their demise were already there. The introduction of the heat was what increased the numbers to the point that they were.
Mm-hmm.
And for him to say that everybody wasn't, it part true, maybe there was some shootings or some other things that happened all the time. But for the most part, the majority, if not almost all of those deaths were related to that heat.
Yeah, in another moment, he said to the press that, you know, people are blowing this out of proportion.
No, people didn't have the resources that were necessary to battle that heat. You know, we were, in addition to ripping and running around all over the city, you know, doing well-being checks and having to deal with the different things we encountered, we would trying to educate the neighborhoods about constantly running the hydrants. You know, if you run the hydrants too long, if you run them at all, we lose water pressure for the immediate area. If there should happen to be a fire, you know, due to any heat related or anything else, you know, we won't have the water pressure to put the fire out. Now, if we can't put the fire out, you know, and it spreads, you know, now we got to try to do rescues. We got to try to do all these things in the gear, in the heat. So you know, it was one thing after another.
So many things, you know? So many factors contributing at the same time.
Hi, my name's Amy.
Hi, my name's Howard, and I distinctly remember the heat wave in 1995.
At that time, I was living in Chicago, and I was pregnant with my first child, and living in an apartment with no central air.
I had finished school, and I was living in Chicago, and we did not have air conditioning, and I remember it being so hot in the apartment that it was impossible to sleep inside, and I had a hammock that I strung across the back porch, and I slept outside for those 5 days.
Just after the heat wave broke, I ended up going into premature labor and had to be taken into admitted to the hospital, and the place was packed. I got the last room. It seemed like once the heat wave broke, things happened.
And even outside, it was just barely manageable. It was crazy weather, and I do remember the power going out, which made even like having a fan in the house for a period of time unavailable. Distinctly remember it, never will forget it.
I went on to have a normal pregnancy, and my child was born happy and healthy when they were due. So, but that's my experience with the heat wave in 95. Thanks.
Thank you to all of you who left voicemails. So, Deputy Commissioner, we talked a bit earlier about how you saw that age range of folks when you first had to show up on scene, right? I want to hear more about the tragic deaths of two young children that came across your watch as well.
Okay. We, sometime after lunchtime, maybe around 1:30, we were called over to just east of Michigan, right off of 103rd. And we didn't know exactly what the call was. It was just down from unknown cause is what I believe we got. We get to the house. There's a couple of teenage girls out front, and they were kind of shaking. We get into the house, and there are 2 3-year-olds laying on the carpet.
Mm.
And this, come to find out, was a home daycare.
Wow.
They had gone on a field trip earlier, and I don't know whether, I don't know who did it, but the children were basically left in the car. There was a Bronco. They were left in the back of the Bronco for hours. And we get there. We get in. They've got some towels and some stuff on the kids trying to cool them. We check them out. We start doing CPR on the kids. And the house was really cold. They really had really good central air in the house. But when we reached out and touched the kids, they were physically hot to the touch, where you drew your hand back like, whoa. Like, how long were they out there, you know?
And my goodness,
it was a mess, because at the time myself and the guy working on the other child, we both had 3-year-olds. You know, this guy's doing CPR on this kid, and he's bawling, crying, you know.
I can only
trying to do this. And the parents showed up, I guess 10-15 minutes after we got there, and you know, trying to maintain control of them and try to deal with these kids.
How do you do that? How do you even begin to deal with the parents showing up to a scene like that? Here's the thing. We started this series yesterday, and we went into some history, and we talked about the fact that, you know, unlike other natural disasters where we can see the destruction, I brought it up earlier too, like, you know, floodings, hurricanes, extreme heat isn't one of those things. So, Stephanie, even when you think back to what we talked about a moment ago with the mayor and some other folks who were in denial, do you think that that can kind of contribute to that sense of complacency?
I think it can. It's subjective, right? We all have different levels of air conditioning. Do we live on the first floor? Do we live in the basement? You know, do we go to work every day and work in air conditioning? You know, do we work outside?
Yeah.
You know, there's such a range of experiences in it, and the fact that you can't see it, you know, makes it a little bit subjective what it is you're suffering from and how you're suffering. So,
So what life lessons then do you all think have remained with you from those 5 days in July 30 years ago? I'd love to hear from everyone at the table, starting with you, Maudlin.
I think for me, the thing that will always stay is the fact that this horrific tragedy was rooted in racial inequity, racial and economic inequity. When the rubber hits the road, it is people who have no access to adequate cooling, adequate heating, and who live in communities that are primarily poor and diverse. And so these are the same factors that played into the COVID pandemic of 2020, mm-hmm. 25 years later. It's the same population that was dying, primarily elderly, poor, and African American. And it is because of the racial and social inequities and systemic racism and injustice in this country. And that's what we have to deal with. We have to address that first, because if we do not, these sorts of deaths from trends of weather, et cetera, will continue to persist.
Stephanie, any life lessons?
You know, my perspective is obviously different than the others here, but the idea of community, of you know, reaching out to others and making sure that they're faring well, it's more automatic now than, because you just don't know what can happen. You know, once you live through something like this, and you know, in the aftermath, you know that you're responsible for connecting with elderly neighbors, with finding out if people are getting adequate care, and doing what you can to help.
Deputy Commissioner, do you think the city learned any lessons from that heat emergency?
Yeah, I believe they learned that.
Walk me through what you're thinking.
What I'm thinking is, because of the magnitude of what took place and how many people wound up losing their lives, their systems were definitely taxed, and I'm sure they were not adequately prepared for what was going on, i.e. the trucks and everything else that they had to bring in and the other methods they used to have to deal with everything and all those bodies at once. It should have also, you know, alerted somebody that there needs to be some research done in some of these areas where all these deaths took place, mm-hmm. to see what possibly could, you know, assist these areas if something similar should happen again. You know, whether it's, you know, maybe setting up programs for distribution of fans if nothing else.
Do you think we would have been further along centers, 30 years later?
You would think, you know, that we would be, but, you know, there are some things that I'm sure are still on the back burner, yeah. even from back then.
Maudlin, you think there's any more investment today in those communities that you just talked about that were hardest hit here?
Unfortunately, the disinvestment remains. There are portions of the West Side that still look the way they did after the fires, the riots of the late 1960s. So Chicago has just dragged its feet on investing in those sorts of communities. But the one positive, the one ray of light that I will carry is that, you know, the lesson was learned, and our systems were enhanced for providing cooling centers, mm-hmm. and heating / warming centers for those communities in times of extreme heat or extreme cold. Those kinds of systems came out of this deadly heat wave of July 1995. And so for that, I'm grateful.
Yeah. So we've moved the needle some.
Yes, just slightly.
We'll leave it there. That's Maudlin Ihajerica, who's a former Chicago Sun-Times reporter. We had Brandon Keller, who's a deputy commissioner for the Chicago Fire Department. He was a firefighter back in 1995. And Stephanie Bainey, who's a longtime Chicagoan and WBEZ listener, thank you all so much for taking the time to join us and share those memories.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here are a few more of your memories from 1995.
Hi, my name is David. I live in Westtown.
Hi, Sasha. My name is Francis.
I was a film worker and shooting ER came into town. And we would typically work outside for 12 hours a day. And we worked all throughout the heat wave.
We had a metal front door. And in 1995, I had my first child. I recall clearly not touching that door with my bare hand because it was burning hot.
I do remember one day specifically where in the morning I drank fluids. The production company was very good about making sure everybody had plenty of water, cool rags to throw on our heads and neck and things. At the end of the day, I realized I had drunk a ton of water, been drinking water all day, and then it hit me that I never urinated once during the day. And it always stuck in my mind after that, that after that kind of heat and everything, that it was just... It was quite a feat, and we were all were proud that we all survived the heat wave of 95. Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye.
This episode was produced by Andrea Guthman and William Balk. It was mixed by Sienna Greaves. To make sure you never miss a conversation about how big news events impact Chicagoans, please consider subscribing. You can also visit wbez.org/reset. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons.
My name is Liz, and as a teacher, I think that WBEZ provides endless sources that I can bring back to my students where they can also engage in a deeper understanding. I teach government, I teach U.S. history, and I have used sources from WBEZ in order to help enrich the understanding of my students.